her head and tried to sleep. Every time she closed her eyes, she saw the figure looming over her, squeezing the life from her body. The blank face under the woolen mask, just a pair of eyes glittering in the half-light. Was it fate that Moss had called at her door at the precise time she had? Why had Erica been spared? Mark was a much better person than she could ever be. He was kind and patient, a brilliant police officer. He'd carved out a place in this world for himself. He'd done much good, and he was capable of so much more. Why had he been taken when she was spared? Chapter 51. Erica stayed with Moss and Celia for a few days. At first she was exhausted and was able to sleep, but soon the pain from her throat and arm, the frustration of being unable to communicate, and the claustrophobia of Moss's tiny back bedroom got to her. Celia was very kind, bringing up trays of warm soup and magazines, and Jacob came to visit her when he got back from school. A couple of times he brought his little DVD player, and they sat in bed and watched Minions in Hotel Transylvania. The details of the case went round and round in Erica's mind. She went back to when Andrea's body was found under the ice, then to meeting her family, Simon and Diana, who live such busy lives that they parented at arm's length. Linda and David were like chalk and cheese, and had vastly different relationships with Andrea, neither knowing what their sister was doing on the night she vanished. Not knowing why she went to a grotty, dangerous pub in South London to meet George Mitchell and the yet a still unidentified blonde-haired woman. And then there was Ivy Norris, who had seen Andrea and her companions that night quite by chance. So too had the barmaid, Christina. Neither of them was around to tell the full story. And then there were the three dead girls. Out of loyalty and kinship, Erica refused to call them prostitutes. Was there a link with Andrea? With Ivy? Or were they just on the wrong street corner at the wrong time? And then there was Marco Frost, whom DCI Sparks had seized upon as their prime suspect, using tenuous yet compelling evidence which had linked him to Andrea. The details of the case spun and tangled in Erica's head, like a giant cat's cradle. Somewhere there was a missing link, something that could link the man who'd tried to kill Erica to all of the other deaths. In her dream, the man visited Erica again, but as he gripped her throat, she was able to reach up and pull away the balaclava covering his head. It was a different face every time. George Mitchell, Simon Douglas Brown, Mark, David, Giles Osborne, even Linda. In Erica's final dream, when she pulled off the balaclava, it was Andrea, just as she had appeared in death, with eyes staring, teeth bared, and her long dark hair wet and full of leaves. As the days passed, Erica heard nothing from Marsh. Moss was busy with court appearances and other cases, and was only able to snatch brief chats in the evening. The police database had drawn a blank with George Mitchell, and a search of electoral records and financial databases also yielded nothing. There was one development. A tiny hair follicle had been recovered from Erica's nightclothes, which could have come from her attacker. But again, it was run through the DNA database and nothing came back. On the fourth morning, her throat was starting to heal, and she was able to speak. Erica knew she had to face up to things and go back to the flat. She thanked Celia and hugged little Jacob goodbye. He gave her a picture he'd drawn, of Erica dressed in a white boiler suit, getting into a UFO to go up into space with a group of minions. It pretty much summed up how she felt. It was quiet in the car as they drove back, Erica wearing a borrowed set of clothes from Celia. Moss eyed her from the driver's seat. "Boss, you all right?" "Yeah. What are you going to do?" "I don't know. Wind up the police tape and then I'm going to go and see my father-in-law." "What about the case?" "Find George Mitchell, Moss. He's the key." "But what about you?" "What about me? I'm suspended. The sensible thing to do is to wait it out until the hearing, where hopefully I'll get my badge back without losing my dignity." "Well, I don't give a shit about my dignity, but I can't do anything without my badge." they'd arrived at Erica's flat. "Thanks, I really appreciate everything," said Erica. "Want me to come in?" "No, you get to work." "I won't give up on the case, boss," promised Moss. "I know, but you've got a family. Do what you have to do." When Erica got back to the flat, it was in disarray. The surfaces were covered in the black magnetic powder used to dust for fingerprints, and crime scene tape still adorned her front door. She went to the bedroom and stared at the bed. She could see the outline of her body in the duvet and the long legs of her assailant, the marks deeper at the knees where he'd lain on top of her. She reached over and pulled the edge of the duvet. The imprint vanished. She worked quickly packing her suitcase. She went to the bathroom and gathered up her toiletries, noting the fingerprint powder on the mirror and the taped-over hole where the extractor fan used to be. She left the house and wheeled her suitcase round to the station. It was a cold, bright day, and she stopped at the coffee shop opposite the station, thinking she'd attempt a coffee even if it hurt. "Sugar, or are you sweet enough?" grinned a handsome waiter with a pierced lip as he took her order. "I need sweetening up," said Erica. "That can be arranged," he said. She watched him as he worked, and when he handed over her coffee, he did so with a wink. Erica grinned back and walked over the road to the station. "Morning. I hope you're not going to be smoking on my nice concourse," said the ticket officer, opening the ticket machine beside Erica. "No, I've given up," said Erica. She chose a single ticket to Manchester Piccadilly Station and fed in her credit card. "Good for you, love," said the ticket officer, closing the machine. He grinned and walked back off to the station. Erica's ticket shot out into the little steel drawer. There were a smattering of people on the platform. She pulled out her phone and dialed Edward's number. He answered after a few rings. His voice lit up when he realised who it was. Erica explained that she was coming up to see him, adding, "I hope it's not too short notice." "No, not at all, love. I just need to make up the bed in the spare room," he said, sounding happy. "Give us a bell when you're close and I'll pop the kettle on." "It'll just be a couple of days. You stay as long or as short as you want." Erica ended the call as the train rounded the track up ahead. She had drained the last of her coffee and was looking for a bin when her phone rang. "Boss, it's me," said Moss breathlessly. "Marco Foss has just been released." The train passed under the footbridge and carriages blurred past. "Released? Why?" asked Erica. "The solicitor has been working on Marco's alibi. He found some CCTV from a newsagent shop in Micheldever." The train was now slowing. Erica could now make out commuters inside the carriages. "Where's Micheldever?" she asked, feeling excitement pricking in her stomach. "An hour south from London Bridge Station. Marco stated in his second alibi that that's where he was going on the night of the 8th of January. As you know, there was insufficient evidence to back that up. Micheldever is a tiny station with no CCTV." "That's been the story of this case. No CCTV," said Moss. The train came to a stop. People on the platform rushed at the train. "The CCTV from a newsagent shows Marco Frost stopping outside to light a cigarette at 8:50 p.m. The newsagent's is a 35-minute walk from the train station. So he did arrive off the 8:10 p.m. train from London Bridge." The train doors opened with a beep, and passengers surged around Erica. Moss continued, "So Marco Frost can now be placed an hour and 35 minutes from London around the time Andrea vanished. It's highly unlikely he could have made it back to the station for the last train into London that evening. He's in the clear." The passengers had now boarded the train. The guard stood on the edge of the platform, waiting as the seconds on the electronic clock ticked by to the departure time. "Of course now Marsh is shitting a brick. The CPS has been crowing to the press how we've caught Andrea's killer, and now a duty solicitor who phoned up a newsagent and asked for a copy of their CCTV video has blown all the case apart. You still there, boss?"
"Yes, I am," said Erica.
The guard blew his whistle.
"Get back if you're not boarding the train," he shouted,
signalling for Erica to get behind the yellow line. She looked at the inside of the carriage. There was a seat just by the door, and warm air flowed out. The doors lit up and gave the warning beep.
I thought you'd be really pleased, boss, asked Moss.
I am. This means...
I wanted to give you the heads up because I think Marsh is going to call you.
The train doors were about to close when a man in a leather jacket came thundering down the stairs from the footbridge. He reached the platform and dived onto the train just as the doors closed on him. With a beeping sound, the doors opened again to free him. There was a ping on Erica's phone. She saw that she had Marsh on her call waiting.
He's calling me now. Okay, I'll get off the line, said Moss. Let me know what's happening.
The doors were now closing. This was her last chance to get on the train and go up north. The doors closed. Erica answered her phone.
DCI Foster, how are you?
Asked Marsh, sounding insincere and panicky.
I now know how a chicken feels seconds before death, she quipped.
The train clicked and whirred and pulled away from the platform.
Sorry I didn't get in contact. It's been...
Yes, I've heard you had to release Marco Frost.
Would you be willing to come into the station? We need to talk, he said.
Erica paused and watched the train move into the distance, vanishing round a bend. I can be there in 15 minutes, sir, she said. She picked up her case, looked at the real world, which she had briefly felt she might join, and then hurried towards the station exit. Chapter 52. There was a fight going on in the reception area when Erica entered Lewisham Row station. Two teenage boys hit the concrete floor with a hollow thud and began to roll around, goaded on by assorted siblings and their equally young mothers. The larger boy clambered on top of the smaller and started to punch his face, the teeth of the smaller boy blurring pink with blood. Wolf waded into the fray, supported by a couple of uniformed officers. Erica ducked through the fighting and was buzzed in through the inside door by Moss.
"Shit, it's good to see you back here," she said, as they started down the corridor.
"Steady on, I've just been summoned, not invited," said Erica, feeling nervous and excited. "Well, Marsh is freaking out," Moss explained.
"That's what happens when you let outside parties dictate an investigation," said Erica. They reached the door to Marsh's office. Moss knocked and they went straight in. Marsh was pale and standing over his computer, watching the breaking news running across the BBC News website, announcing that Marco Frost had been released.
"Thank you, Detective Moss. DCI Foster, please sit."
"I'd like Moss to stay, sir. She's been working on this whilst I've been..."
"I'm aware of your investigations."
There was a brisk knock at the door, and Marsh's secretary poked her head round. "I've got Sir Simon Douglas Brown on the line, says it's urgent."
Marsh pushed his hand through his short hair and looked harassed.
"I'm in an important meeting here. Please relay that, and I'll call him back ASAP. Thanks."
The secretary nodded and left, closing the door.
"I'm your important meeting?" asked Erica.
Marsh came round to his desk and sat. Erica and Moss each pulled up a chair. Marsh attempted a smile.
"Look, DCI Foster, Erica, what has happened is unfortunate. I admit you may have been treated unfairly, and I will address this properly in due course. However, we find ourselves suddenly in the midst of a crisis. We're on the back foot here. I need all the information and insights you have from your alternative investigation."
"Which, I hope, will now become your priority investigation."
"I will be the judge of that. Just tell me everything you've got," said Marsh.
"No," said Erica.
"No?"
"Boss, I'll tell you everything, and I'll outline my theories when you've returned my badge and reinstated me as SIO on this investigation."
Erica sat back and stared at Marsh.
"Who do you think you are to come in here?" he started.
"Okay, I'll leave you to your chat with Sir Simon. Say hi from me."
Erica got up to leave.
"What you're asking is nearly impossible. You've got a serious allegation against you, DCI Foster."
"I call bullshit. Assistant Commissioner Oakley was acting on orders from Simon Douglas Brown to remove me from this case. Little Matthew Norris has been in and out of youth detention for years. He's assaulted several social workers and, I'll repeat, at the time I hit him, his teeth were latched onto the back of my hand. Now, if that's what this whole case swings on, then fine. But you'll be waving goodbye to someone who can catch this guy. And, of course, I'll repeat this to the press because I won't go quietly."
Marsh ran his fingers through his hair.
Sir, Marco Frost has just pulled together an alibi and made you all look like a bunch of bumbling comedy policemen. Didn't DCI Sparks think to do a few background checks? I mean, for God's sake, CCTV from a news agent. Oh, and I'll also make sure that the press know there's a killer still out there on the loose, thanks to you, DCI Sparks, and of course, the sleek fox himself, Assistant Commissioner Oakley. Marsh looked as if he were going to explode. Erica stared at him, not looking away. "Put me back on the case and I'll catch this bastard," she said. Marsh got up and went to the window, looking out at the bleak January landscape. He turned. "For fuck's sake. Okay, but you are on a very short leash. Do you understand, DCI Foster?" Moss gave Erica a small, triumphant smile. "I understand. Thank you, sir." Marsh came and sat back down. "Well, go on, give me your insights."
"Okay, let's go public with this. Launch a fresh appeal, and if you can pull some strings, let's get a television reconstruction going. We're going to face flak for Marco Frost, sir, and you need to be ready to bombard the press with all the things we are doing, so they concentrate on that, not all the things that we didn't do."
Marsh looked at Erica. She went on. "We've already celebrated once that we caught the killer. We can't do it again unless we really do catch him. So let's get ahead of the news cycle. Make George Mitchell our main focus. Flood the press with the image of him with Andrea. We also need a scapegoat. The press will want to see that someone is paying for this fuck-up. And I know just the person."
Chapter 53. Erica took a deep breath and opened the door to the incident room. DCI Sparks stood talking at the front by the whiteboards, which were stripped bare. The rest of the team sat around the room despondently. Sparks looked angry and haggard, his long dark hair pulled back from his face and spots of grease blooming where his hair touched his collar.
"I'll be talking to you one by one, and I'll be asking tough questions. We're going to go back to the beginning and root out exactly who failed to check the basic fucking timeline of Marco Frost's journey from boarding the train at London Bridge to..."
Sparks' voice tailed off as he saw Erica enter with Moss.
"You here to pick up your P-45, Foster?" he sneered. The rest of the officers remained stony-faced.
"No, my badge, actually," said Erica, flashing it to Sparks. He looked confused.
"Do you take the title SIO seriously, DCI Sparks?"
"Well, seeing as only one of us has it, yes," he said. "Can I help you? I'm in the middle of a briefing here."
"SIO means Senior Investigating Officer. The senior part doesn't mean you're older than everyone and entitled to bully them when the shit hits the fan. It means you take responsibility for your fuck-ups."
"I don't understand," said Sparks, losing a little of his resolve.
"That's been the problem. I've been reinstated as SIO, and my first order is that you need to piss off to Marsh's office."
DCI Sparks froze.
"Now, DCI Sparks!"
He stared at Erica, along with the rest of the incident room, and then he went slowly to his desk, picked up his coat and walked out. Before he was out of the door, Crane started to applaud. Other officers joined in, and Peterson put his fingers to his lips and whistled. Erica was touched and looked down as she blushed.
"All right, you lot," she said. "It's much appreciated, but there's still a murderer out there."
The applause died down. Erica went to the whiteboard at the front. She pinned up the picture of Andrea and George Mitchell.
"This is our prime suspect, George Mitchell, Andrea Douglas Brown's lover and ultimately her killer. Also suspected in the rape and murder of Tatiana Ivanova, Mirka Bratova, Karolina Todorova and Ivy Norris."
The room was silent. Until today, the focus has been on the murder of Andrea Douglas Brown. Her face has been on the front of every newspaper, internet browser and television screen, and has worked its way into the national conscience.
Yes, she was rich and privileged.
But she experienced a terrible death, alone, scared and helpless.
Tatiana Ivanova, Mirka Bratova, Karolina Todorova and Ivy Norris may have been prostitutes, but I can guarantee this was not a world they entered into willingly.
Given different circumstances, they could have been as lucky as Andrea in life. They, too, had a harrowing demise. I say all this because I want you to forget where these women stood in society. Don't do what we do in this country day in, day out, and divide them into their social classes. They are all equals, all victims, and they deserve our equal attention.
Erica paused. Crane had started to pin up photos of the victims.
So this is our person of extreme interest and our main focus, said Erica, pointing to the photo of George Mitchell. He was in a sexual relationship with Andrea, and they were photographed together 4 days before Andrea went missing. I also believe she met him and an unidentified blonde woman on the night she was taken. I want you all to review the full contents of Andrea Douglas Brown's second phone on the intranet. Please look at them with fresh eyes. There are no stupid questions. We find this man, and I believe we unlock this case.
The officers nodded in unison.
Erica went on. This afternoon we're going to make a fresh public appeal for information. We're going out with full guns, naming George Mitchell as a suspect. Hopefully it will lead to new information, or flush him out from wherever he is hiding.
Erica paused, checking that she had their full attention. She continued,
Please also focus on our other victims. The murders of Tatiana Ivanova, Mirka Bratova, and Karolina Todorova are unsolved cases which have never been linked before.
I want the evidence pulled on all three murders and revisited. Look for links, any similarities. Did the victims know each other? If so, how and why?
There was a knock at the door of the incident room, and Colleen, the police press officer, entered.
Sorry to interrupt, DCI Foster. I'm expecting a conference call from Reuters at any moment. I thought you'd want to sit in on it, she said.
Right, thank you, everyone. We need to get ahead on this. Put Marco Frost to the back of your minds. Tune out the press. Drop your preconceived ideas. Concentrate on what is in front of us here and now. We get ahead of the news cycle and we'll start to win this.
Erica rose and left the incident room as it began to buzz with activity. Chapter 54. The press appeal was in stark contrast to the previous press conference in Marble Arch. Erica had insisted it was held on the steps of Lewisham Row Station, and that it should be more genuine and urgent than the polished nature of the previous press conference, with its video screens and elegant conference room. In addition, Erica had insisted that Marsh not be present, which hadn't gone down well. The light was fading by the time that Erica, Moss and Peterson gathered on the steps of Lewisham Row, in front of the assorted television and print journalists. A harsh light was trained on them, which bounced off the chipped wood of the station's main entrance behind.
"Thank you for attending today," Erica began, raising her voice above the crowd. She was faced with scores of lenses. The television cameras trained their lenses on the stairs, and cameras fired off flashes.
Moss and Peterson stared straight ahead. Erica continued.
I guess that many of you here today might already have written this story and made up your minds about what I'm going to say. But before you drift off and metaphorically file your copy in your head, writing luridly about police incompetence, or before you decide that Andrea's death is more newsworthy than that of someone who wasn't born into a life of privilege, think back to why we are all here today. Our job is to catch the bad guys. Your job is to report on that in a fair and just manner.
Yes, we do use each other. The police use the press to further our cause and to spread a message. You sell column inches. So, ladies and gentlemen of the press, I ask that we work together today. Let me give you a new story to run with.
Erica paused.
Marco Frost was today released from custody due to insufficient evidence. He was able to supply us with an alibi, and we had no choice but to release him. He's an innocent man, but that is not your story. The story is that the killer of Andrea is still out there, at large in society. After reviewing the evidence and refocusing the investigation, we have strong reason to believe that the death of Andrea wasn't an isolated crime. The man we are looking for has killed previously. We believe he is responsible for the death of 3 young Eastern European women, Tatiana Ivanova, Mirka Bratova, and Karolina Todorova.
They all came to London in the belief that there would be a good job here for them. What happened, however, is that they were trafficked as prostitutes and forced to work to pay off a debt. We also believe that the same individual is responsible for the death of 47-year-old Ivy Norris. Now, please, you will see a photo of our prime suspect in this case. His name is George Mitchell.
Back in the incident room, Superintendent Marsh was watching the press conference with Colleen as it went out live on the BBC News channel.
"It looks amateurish, and she's coming across as a bit schoolmarmish," he said.
As the picture cut away from Erica Mawson-Peterson in the glare of the cameras to a photo of George Mitchell.
"Of course, a woman is confident of her opinion and she's schoolmarmish," said Colleen.
A number and email address flashed along the bottom of the screen. After a few moments, the screen cut back to Erica.
"Please, if you have any information about this man, contact us using the details on your screens. Your call will be dealt with in confidence. We also advise anyone who sees this man not to approach him. I thank the members of the press for your time and for your help with this matter."
There was a pause on screen, and then journalists began to shout out questions.
"Will Marco Frost be entitled to compensation?"
shouted one voice.
"Marco Frost's case will be treated in the same way as all others. The Crown Prosecution Service will be looking into it as a matter of urgency," said Erica. The journalists started to bombard Erica with more questions.
"Are these murders linked to the business activities of Sir Simon Douglas Brown?"
"I think what we need to remember that Sir Simon is a father whose daughter died in a horrific manner, just like the other girls. They also have family who feel their loss every day. This investigation has already been hampered by the perceived manner in which we should do things. What we realise now is that Andrea's secrets are the very thing that will lead us to the killer. Please don't judge her or her family."
"Christ, I knew this was a bad idea," said Marsh.
"No, this is good.
She's really connecting with people. This press conference is much more real and genuine than before," said Colleen.
Marsh gave her a sideways glance, but she was glued to the screen. The press conference then cut away to a wide shot as Erica Mawson-Peterson made their way up the steps and back into the station. The television cut back to the BBC News studio, where the news anchor asked the reporter at the scene for his comments.
"This is a bold move by the police, who after several weeks still have very little in the way of evidence. With a suspect at large, time is running out."
"What does he mean, running out?" scoffed Marsh. On the screen, the reporter carried on.
"Sir Simon Douglas Brown has been faced with a fresh round of newspaper revelations over his links to Saudi Arabian arms deals. An extramarital affair has also been hinted at."
The camera then cut back to the news anchor. This press conference was a marked departure in the police investigation, whereas in previous weeks the Met seemed to be dancing to the tune of the Douglas Brown family. Are they now putting forward a credible line of inquiry based upon evidence which the family would perhaps rather be kept out of the media? The camera cut back to the reporter outside Lewisham Row.
"I think yes. I believe this press conference may have hurt the relationship between the establishment and the police force, but it may well give the police more credibility and autonomy, which will, I'm sure, help to gain back the support of the public."
"There you see, that's the angle we're looking for. I'll make some calls and get the tape of these comments circulated," said Colleen.
Marsh felt a prickle of sweat forming on his brow, and he felt his phone vibrate in his pocket. Pulling it out, he saw it was Simon Douglas Brown.
Chapter 55. The past few days had passed in a haze of frustration. To have come so close, and then to have to pull back, had left the figure raging inside. Not only had DCI Foster survived, she'd come back from it stronger. She's been put back on the fucking case. After witnessing the appeal from Lewisham Row, where DCI Foster had publicly linked the murders, the figure was torn. There was an instinct to flee far away to start again, but there was also an itch which needed to be scratched. The link had been made, but the police had nothing. The figure was sure of this.
So at 6 p.m. The figure drove up to Paddington train station, where the cabs dropped off and picked up passengers, and where the girls hung around. The girl looked confused when the figure pulled up in the car. She was standing a little way down the end of a dirty slip road which was used by cabs to turn around, or by people on the lookout for a good time.
"I can give you a good time," she said automatically. She was a thin girl with a strong Eastern European accent.
She shivered in tight leggings, a spaghetti-strapped top, and a large, ratty, fake fur coat. She had pale, pointed features and shoulder-length, poker-straight hair. Her eyes were surrounded by glittery eyeshadow and she was chewing gum. She leaned back against the skip, waiting for a response. "I'm looking for a good time. Something a bit different, a bit rarer."
"Oh, yeah? Well, you know when stuff is rare, it costs more."
"I know your boss," said the figure. She scoffed at him.
"Yeah, they all say that. If you're looking for a discount, you can fuck off," she said, going to turn away.
The figure leaned forward and told her a name. She stopped and came back to the window, dropping all pretense of being alluring. Her eyes were frightened, fear surrounded by glitter.
"Did he send you?"
she asked, looking around at the cars roaring past. "No, but he knows I put a lot of business his way, so he'll expect me to get what I want." The girl narrowed her eyes. Her instincts were good. This might be harder than expected.
"So, you come here and drop the name of my boss. What do you want me to do?"
"I like outdoor scenes," said the figure.
"Okay.
And I like it when the girl plays scared."
"You mean you want a rape fantasy?"
said the girl bluntly, rolling her eyes. She looked around and pulled down her top, showing her small pert breasts.
"That will cost more."
"I can afford it," said the figure. She pulled her top up.
"Yeah, show me."
The figure pulled out a wallet and opened it, pushing it under her nose. The money was in a crisp block glinting under the streetlights.
"1,500 and we have a safe word,"
she said, pulling a mobile phone from her leggings. The figure put a hand out and covered the phone.
"No, no, no, no. I want this as real as possible. Within the realms of fantasy, don't tell anyone where you're going. I have to call."
"An extra 500. The boss doesn't have to know."
"No way. He finds out and I don't get to have a safe word."
"Okay, all above board. 2 grand. And the safe word is Erica."
"Erica?"
"Yes, Erica." The girl looked around and chewed on her lip.
"Okay,"
she said. She pulled open the door and got into the car. The figure drove off, activating the central locking. Telling her this, too, was part of the game. Chapter 56. The incident room was rather quiet after the press conference. Officers milled around as the occasional phone rang. An air of expectation needed to be quenched. The few calls that did come through were from the usual time-wasters.
"Jesus, you'd think that someone would come forward with information," said Erica, looking at her watch.
"I can't bear this. I'm nipping out for a cigarette." She had just reached the steps of the police station when Detective Crane appeared behind her.
"Boss, you'll want to take this," he said.
"Who is it?" asked Erica.
"We've got a young girl on the line who says she's Barbara Kardoshova, Andrea's long-lost best friend," said Crane.
Erica hurried back with him to the incident room and took the call.
"Is this the police officer who was on the television this afternoon?"
asked a young female voice with an Eastern European accent.
"Yes. This is Detective Chief Inspector Erica Foster. Do you have information about George Mitchell?"
"Yes," she said. There was a pause. "But I can't talk on the phone."
"I can assure you that anything you say here will be treated confidentially," said Erica.
She looked down and saw it was a withheld number. Erica looked over at Crane, who nodded to show he was already working on a trace.
"I'm sorry. I won't talk on the phone," the girl said, her voice shaking.
"Okay. That's okay. Can I meet you?"
asked Erica.
It can be anywhere you like.
Peterson was hastily scribbling on his notepad. He held up a sign which read, Get her to come into station.
Are you in London? Would you like to come to the station here at Lewisham Row?
No.
The girl's voice was now panicky. There was a pause. Erica looked up at Crane, who mouthed that it was a pay-as-you-go phone.
Hello, Barbara, are you still there? Yes, I'm not saying any more over the phone. I need to tell you things. I can meet you tomorrow at 11 a.m. Here's the address.
Erica scribbled it down hastily and went to ask more, but the line was dead. It was a pay-as-you-go, boss, no joy, said Crane. She sounded really rattled, said Erica, replacing the phone.
Where does she want to meet?
Asked Peterson. Erica tapped the address into her computer. A picture on Google Maps popped up on screen. It was a vast expanse of green.
Norfolk,
said Erica.
Norfolk? What the hell is she doing in Norfolk?
Asked Moss. Erica's mobile phone rang. She saw it was Edward.
Sorry, I just have to take this. Can you work out a route and we'll decide how to proceed when I come back?
She said and left the incident room. The corridor outside was quiet and she answered her phone.
So, lass, I take it you're not coming,
said Edward. Erica saw that it was 5 past 5.
I'm so sorry. You're not still waiting there, on the platform?
No, lass, I saw you on the telly this afternoon and I thought, unless you can fly, you wouldn't be here at 5 o'clock. Erica thought back. The morning seemed like a million years ago. You did well for that press conference, love, said Edward.
You made me care about that girl, Andrea.
She hasn't been getting very nice things said about her in the papers, has she?
Thank you. It all happened at once. I was called in this morning. I was about to get on the train to you and...
And it all got away from you, eh?
Yes,
said Erica softly. Listen, love, you do what you have to do. I'll be here for you. Moss appeared at the door, signalling that she wanted to speak.
Sorry, I have to go. Can I phone you back later?
Asked Erica.
Yes, love. Take care of yourself, won't you?
You catch that bloke, lock him up, and throw away the key.
I will,
said Erica. There was a click and Edward hung up.
I will, I promise I will, she repeated.
Taking a deep breath, she went back into the incident room, wondering exactly when she'd be able to honour her promise.
Chapter 57
Erica, Moss and Peterson set off early from London the next day to meet Barbara Kardoshova.
They had tried a search on her several times, but it had brought up a blank. Her national insurance, passport and bank account numbers had ceased activity more than a year previously. Her mother had died 2 years previously, and she had no other living relatives. Just as the sun broke through the clouds, they plunged into the gloom of the Blackwall Tunnel. When they emerged a few moments later, the sun had vanished again behind a bank of steel-coloured clouds.
"Now we've crossed the river. We're looking for the A-12, boss," said Moss.
Peterson sat in the back, engrossed in his phone. They'd stopped for petrol just before Greenwich, and Moss had indulged her sweet tooth with packets of red licorice bootlaces. The built-up sprawl of London soon gave way to the A-12 dual carriageway, which was neglected and crumbling in places, and they noticed how flat the landscape was. Brown trees with bare trees whizzed past, and towards Ipswich they turned off the dual carriageway and slowed as they hit a single-lane road.
"It's quite eerie, isn't it? This straight road through nothing," remarked Peterson, speaking for the first time in 100 miles.
The road carved its way through a vast expanse of flat fields, and the wind roared across the bare soil, buffeting the car. The road rose up a little, and they crossed a metal bridge over a canal of choppy water. Dead grey reeds lined the straight waterway all the way to the horizon. Erica wondered if the water reached the edge and poured away into nothingness.
"It's an old Roman road, the A-12,
said Moss, stuffing another red bootlace into her mouth and chewing.
"They burnt hundreds of witches in Suffolk and Norfolk,"
added Peterson, as they passed a deserted windmill in a field next to the water.
"I'll take high prices, door-to-door traffic, smog and a crowded Nando's over this any day,"
said Moss, shivering and turning up the car heater. "How far?"
There's about 6 miles to go, said Peterson, consulting his iPhone.
The trees thickened, and the landscape changed to woodland. The car sped along under a canopy of bare trees, and Erica slowed as she spied a lay-by with a picnic area, which was no more than a scrub of soil and a picnic bench.
A wooden sign had the number 14 painted on it.
What did she say, picnic area 17? Asked Erica.
Yes, boss, said Peterson, tapping on his phone.
They carried on a little more as the woods seemed to get denser. The road wove to the left and right past picnic area 15. They took a sharp bend, and a picnic bench with the number 16 slid past. The picnic area was overgrown. The bench was rotten and had collapsed.
Advise on your status, said Detective Crane's voice, bursting through with static on the police radio mounted on the dashboard.
We'll be approaching within the next few minutes, Skip, said Moss.
Okay, keep an open line of communication. That's what the super asked for, said Crane.
Superintendent Marsh had been against sending three of his officers off to Norfolk on what he thought was a wild goose chase.
Boss, Barbara Kardoshova was one of Andrea's closest friends, and she says she knows George Mitchell,
Erica had pointed out when she was sitting in his office.
Why hasn't she come forward before? Andrea has been in the newspapers for weeks. And why don't we get the local plod to take a statement? You'll be gone for a whole day. You've just launched a major appeal in London, said Marsh.
Sir, this is our strongest lead. We'll leave early. We'll be in contact the whole time. Again, I'd like you to entertain my hunch on this one.
Why was she using an unlisted number? We've no idea of her whereabouts, said Marsh, leaning back in his chair and rubbing his eyes.
Maybe she doesn't want to be found. That's not an offence, is it? Asked Erica.
It would make everything far more bloody easy if everyone was tagged at birth with a GPS tracker. It would save a fortune.
I'll be sure to pass that along to the next journalist I meet, said Erica.
Keep me informed every step of the way,
he had said irritably, waving her away with a hand. The sky had grown heavy, and Moss had to put on the car headlights. The surrounding woodland was now thick, and the bare branches seemed impenetrable. The sign with the number 17 appeared up ahead, and they came to a stop at a patch of bare soil. The bench had been removed, leaving 4 deep impressions in the soil. Moss killed the engine and the lights, and they were left in silence. When Erica opened the door, a cold breeze floated past, bringing with it the smell of damp and rotting leaves. She buttoned up her coat as Peterson and Moss joined her.
So now what? Asked Moss.
She said she'd meet us here. She was very specific, said Erica, pulling out the scrap of paper where she'd written the original directions. They looked at the road beside them. It was empty in both directions.
There looks like a track up ahead here, said Moss.
They made towards a gap in the dead brambles and undergrowth. After squeezing through for several metres, it opened out onto a track for walkers. It was well kept, under a huge canopy of trees stretching away to a corner where the track disappeared. Erica imagined that in the summer this bleak and creepy woodland corner felt different. They waited for almost 40 minutes, the radio clicking and beeping as Crane back in London checked their status.
It's a bloody wind-up, said Peterson. No doubt it was the woman who said...
His voice trailed off as they heard the crack of a stick breaking and the whoosh of leaves being disturbed. Erica put her finger to her lips. There was a rustling, and through the undergrowth came a woman with short blonde hair. She wore a pink waterproof jacket and black leggings. She held a knife in her hand and what looked like a canister of mace in the other. She stopped 50 yards from where they stood.
What the fuck? Said Moss.
Erica shot her a look.
Barbara? Barbara Kardoshova?
I'm DCI Erica Foster. These are my colleagues, Detective Moss and Detective Peterson.
Take out your IDs and throw them over here,
said Barbara. Her voice shook with fear, and as she came closer they could see her hands did too.
Hang on, started Moss.
But Erica put her hand in her pocket, pulled out her ID and slung it across. It landed a few feet from Barbara. Moss and Peterson reluctantly did the same. She picked them up,
and keeping the canister of mace trained in their direction, looked through their ID.
Okay, you can see we are who we say we are. Now please put the knife and the mace away, said Erica.
Barbara put them down on the ground and came cautiously towards the three of them. Erica could just make out the face from the picture she'd seen on Facebook. It was still beautiful, but the nose was now smaller and straighter, the face was fuller, and the long dark hair was now short and dyed blonde. A dark-haired man and a blonde-haired girl, thought Erica.
Why are we going through all this just to talk to you? Started Moss. You know we could nick you here and now for having that knife. It's more than 7 inches long, and don't get me started on the mace.
Barbara had tears in her eyes.
I'm so scared, but I have to talk to you. There are things I have to tell you, or I'll never forgive myself. I shouldn't have contacted you using my real name, she said. I'm in the Witness Protection Program.
Chapter 58. They froze for a moment, Moss, Peterson and Erica. The wind rushed through the treetops above.
I'm not going to tell you my new name, said Barbara, shakily.
No, said Erica, holding up her hand. Don't say anything more. Shit, this should have been bloody obvious, said Moss. There was a faint beep from the open car window, and they heard Crane ask for their status and position. We've got to call this in, boss. If someone in witness protection reveals themselves or is revealed, then we have to call it in, said Moss. You'll need a new identity, said Peterson, trying to hide his annoyance.
Wait, please. There are things I have to say, said Barbara. I met you because I have to talk to you about George Mitchell.
She swallowed and shook even more. I should tell you his real name.
What's his real name? Asked Erica.
Barbara gulped, and it seemed like a physical effort to say it. Igor Kucherov, she said finally. Peterson made for the car where the radio was.
Please, let me tell you everything before you make it official.
There was another pause. Crane's tinny voice floated from far away, asking for their status and position. Peterson, tell him we're still waiting. All is okay, and please, Peterson, nothing about this until we've heard her out, said Erica. He nodded, and then sprinted off back to the car. We don't want to know your new name or where you're living around here, said Erica.
I live far away from here. I have more to lose than all of you put together, but I've made my mind to finally speak, she said.
If we double back a bit, there is a picnic spot up ahead. They followed, leaving Peterson to man the radio in the car. After a 5-minute walk, they came into a clearing with a picnic bench. The light had difficulty penetrating a canopy of branches high above. Again, Erica thought it must be beautiful on a summer's day, but in the cold and gloom it was oppressive. She pushed this to the back of her mind, and she and Moss sat down opposite Barbara, the table between them. Erica offered Barbara a cigarette, and she took one gratefully from the pack. Her hands shook as she leaned in, cupping her hand for a light. Erica lit her own and Moss's, and they inhaled in unison. Barbara looked as if she was going to throw up. She ran her hand through her short blonde hair. It was bleached cheaply, with a yellow straw-like appearance. She gulped and started to speak, her voice shaky.
I first met George Mitchell, Igor Kucherov, 3 years ago when I was 20. I lived in London, and I was working two jobs. One in a private members' club in central London called Debussy's. She took another drag on her cigarette and went on. I worked shifts there, and at the same time I worked in a cafe in New Cross called The Junction. It was fun, vibrant place, where local artists, painters and poets met. It was also where I first met Igor. He was a regular customer, and every time he came in, we started to talk. Back then I thought he was gorgeous and so funny. I was flattered he spent time talking to me. One day I was in work and very upset. My little iPod had broken, and it had songs and photos on it that I couldn't replace. He was kind, but I didn't think anything of it. When I came for my next shift a few days later, he was there, waiting with a gift bag, and inside was a new iPod.
Not like the tiny little one I had, but the newest and most expensive, worth several hundred pounds.
And that's when you started a relationship with George, Igor? Asked Moss.
Barbara nodded. It was growing darker, and a cloud was looming above. At first he was so wonderful. I thought I was in love, and that I'd found the man I would spend the rest of my life with.
What did your family think of him?
It was just me and my mother. She came to England when she was in her 20s. She wanted to meet a man and live a nice middle-class life, but then she fell pregnant with me. Her boyfriend at the time didn't want to know, so she had me on her own and struggled as a single mother. Then when I was 10, she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. It was slow at first, but when I was 16, she got really bad. I had to leave school and look after her. I took these jobs in the mornings at the cafe and nights at the club.
So how long were you in a relationship with Igor? Asked Moss, gently moving her story forward.
About a year. He did so much in that time, helping us out. He paid for a special bathroom to be put in for my mother. He cleared my credit cards.
Barbara smiled off in the distance, the memory still alive in her mind. She took a drag on her cigarette and her face clouded over.
Then it was a few months into our relationship. One night we'd been to the cinema in Bromley. These boys had been making comments about me when we bought our tickets, stuff about my body. Igor had got angry, but I told him to leave it. We went inside and watched the film, and I thought he'd forgotten about it. When we came out, it was late, and there weren't many people around. Igor saw one of the boys leave, and he walked in front of us to the car park. When we were near our car, he just went for him, punching and kicking. It was like an animal. This boy went down on the ground, and Igor just kept on kicking him, stamping on his head. I'd never seen him like this. It shocked me. I tried to pull him away, but he punched me in the face, too. Finally, when he had no more energy, he just walked away. He left the boy lying on the floor in the dark.
Barbara began to cry. Moss pulled out a small packet of tissues. She held them across the table, and Barbara took one. She took a deep breath and wiped her face.
"And I followed him," she said. "We just left the boy on the ground between two cars. Igor made me drive, even though I wasn't insured on his car, and I did."
He grabbed my handbag and found my makeup remover wipes and cleaned the blood off his knuckles and some that had sprayed on his face. And then he dropped me home. I didn't see him for a few days until he showed up with a gift, and my mum was so happy to see him. I just took it and carried on as if nothing had happened.
"What happened to the boy?" asked Erica.
Barbara shrugged. There was a far-off rumble of thunder and a flicker of lightning.
"So where does Andrea come into all this?" asked Moss.
"A few weeks after I started work in the Club de Bussy's behind the bar, Andrea came in for a drink. It was quiet, and I served her a drink, and we got chatting. She started coming in more regularly, and I slowly got to know her. She said how much she hated all the snobby trust fund girls she'd been to school with. When she heard I lived south of the river, she said she'd love to come and visit me. She said it was like going off on a package holiday or something. But New Cross is only 10 minutes on the train from Charing Cross."
Barbara laughed bitterly. "So did Andrea come to your house?"
Barbara shook her head.
"No, she used to come to the Junction, the coffee place where I worked. She loved it. It was so bohemian. And there were always interesting people there, people who lived life free, not in a cage. That's what she said. I said her cage was gilded, but she didn't get that. I don't think she knew what the word gilded meant."
"When did she tell you who her father was?"
"Not at first. And she made this big thing about keeping it a secret. But then she spent more time at the cafe and became quite competitive with some of the girls who'd hang around the artists and painters. She started to let it drop into conversation."
"And what did people say?" asked Erica.
"Most of them were quite blasé, but George, Igor, took interest. When he found out, it was like he suddenly noticed Andrea."
"Did he have an affair with Andrea?"
Barbara nodded.
"It happened so fast, and I was so brainwashed by it all."
"At this stage, was he being violent with you, Barbara?"
"No. Well, sometimes. It was more the threat of violence, the control. When I found out about Andrea, that's when he first properly hit me.
Where was this?
Asked Erica.
At home.
It was a Sunday night and my mother was in the bath. I don't know why it came up at that time, but it did, and I confronted him.
What happened?
He punched me in the stomach. It was so hard I threw up. And then he locked me in the cupboard under the stairs.
How long for?
Not long. I was pleading because my mother was in the bath and getting cold. I had to help her out. He said he'd only let me out if I promised not to mention him and Andrea again.
And did you?
Barbara shook her head.
What happened next?
Asked Erica. Things were normal for a while. It kind of calmed down. Then I was at home one day. Igor arrived at the kitchen door at the back of the house. He had this young girl with him. She could have only been 18. She could barely stand and was dressed in skinny jeans and a tight T-shirt. Her face was a mess of blood. Some of it was dry and some of it was new, and it all came down the front of her T-shirt. She was crying, and what was I supposed to do? I let them in. But Igor didn't want to help her. He went to that cupboard under the stairs and he put her in there and he locked it. He was crazy, swearing he just wanted to know where his phone was. He said this girl had taken it.
The storm was coming close now, and under the tree it was very gloomy.
What happened to the girl?
Asked Erica softly.
Igor sent me upstairs. He told me to stay in my room or there would be trouble. I heard the girl screaming and crying. It went on for what seemed like hours, and then it went quiet. Igor opened the door and asked to go to my mother's room. She smiled when she saw him. She'd slept through it all. He asked for my sports bag, the big one I used when I went away. I went to the wardrobe and I pulled it out and he took it. He was so calm. I went downstairs a few minutes later and he was leaving with the bag over his shoulder.
What was in the bag?
Asked Moss, even though they knew the answer.
The girl, said Barbara. She was in the bag and he just left.
What did you do? Asked Erica. I cleaned up the mess in the cupboard. There was blood and other stuff.
And then?
He came back later and he told me I'd done a good job. He even gave me some money. Barbara's voice was full of self-loathing. And then we carried on again, as if nothing had happened. But he started to tell me about his work, how he'd meet girls from the buses at Victoria Coach Station, how they came to work for him.
To work as what? Asked Erica.
Prostitutes. The more I knew, the more Igor kept giving me money. He bought my mother a new electric wheelchair she could use herself. She didn't have to be pushed anymore. It changed her life.
And how is Andrea part of this?
I was so stressed I couldn't eat. My period stopped. Igor just didn't look at me that way anymore, so Andrea took over. She provided him with that service.
Was all this going on when you went on the family holidays with Andrea?
Yes.
Did you know that later on Andrea got engaged?
Barbara nodded and accepted another cigarette.
And did Andrea know about Igor? Did she know what kind of work he did? Asked Erica.
I don't know. I never discussed it with her. We'd been close at first. And we still were weirdly close on the holidays with her family. But I withdrew into myself. I think Andrea had this romantic notion that Igor was some kind of roguish London gangster, like in the stupid Guy Ritchie films.
So how did you come to be in the witness protection program?
Asked Moss. The body of the girl was discovered in my bag a few months later.
Where?
A landfill in East London. The bag had an old store card belonging to me in the inside pocket. It led the police to my door. They said they'd been watching me for a long time and that I could strike a bargain for giving evidence.
And you did?
Yeah. My mother, she died just before this, thank God. She never knew. Igor seemed to trust me by now. He wanted me to start coming to Victoria Coach Station to meet the girls. They thought they were coming to England to work as housekeepers. He figured if I was there, they'd trust me and get in the car.
Igor was trafficking women to London to work as prostitutes? Asked Erica.
Yes.
Was he working alone?
No, I don't know. It was all so complicated. There were other men involved and their girlfriends.
Where were the girls taken? How many girls were there?